This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to the morning run on BFM 89.9, the business station. 6 o'clock on the 10th of February. It's a Friday morning, so happy Friday to Tan Chung Han, who's here with me this morning.
I'm happy Friday!
And I'm extra chirpy because, of course, yesterday was a public holiday. Did you have a good break?
Yeah, Taipusam was good. Unfortunately, I did not partake in the traditional Taipusam festivities.
Have you ever been?
No, I have not, actually.
Have you? Yeah, in Penang. And, you know, Taipusam is hugely celebrated in Penang. So I did the walk through Batu Feringhi, and that was really fun.
Wow.
Used to do that almost every year when I was in school. Yeah, because I had a lot of Indian friends, and then we used to just do it together. It was just a thing that you would do on Taipusam.
Well, I feel bad now because I do have a lot of Indian friends. I mean, I am from Klang, so there's a stereotype there, you know. But yeah, unfortunately, I can't say the same. So that might have to change come 2018. We'll see.
The midweek public holiday kind of threw me off a little bit yesterday. I woke up in a panic going, oh my God, I've missed the morning show. And I realized, wait a minute, it's a public holiday. I can sleep in a little bit more. So that was fun. The knowledge of being able to go back to sleep.
Oh, I know, right? But then it is a bit weird because then you have this one day that we just come in, do work, and then we've got a weekend then again. It's a bit anticlimactic, you know. It's like it's kind of a Friday, but not really.
Not quite,
you know,
not quite.
So I think we should have just had that four-day weekend.
It's like,
you know,
semi-productive,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. You know, but hey, you know, we are here and we're going to try and put on a good show.
Exactly. Yeah. In fact, on The Breakfast Grill, I'm going to be speaking to Frank Meehan, co-founder and CEO of the micro-learning platform SmartUp. You know, Frank is really quite a fascinating guy because he is a global technopreneur. He was on the he was a former board member of Spotify. He was with Siri when they were first starting up, with Sumly, the text condensing app, Skype as well. He has, all in all, invested in 120 tech investments so far. Can you imagine?
Wow, he's been around the block. 120. Like, you know, I'm certainly looking forward to the kind of insights that he can share with us.
Yeah.
Like, given that really, really impressive CV right there.
Yeah, I mean 120.
Wow.
120. I mean, to have been involved in these tech giants when they were, just little startups. So really, I feel like he can identify what's going to be the next big thing in tech. Mm. So that's why I was particularly interested in talking to him about the his new micro-learning platform. So this is SmartUp. It's an app for startups, if you haven't gotten that yet. It puts entrepreneurs directly in touch with mentors, but it has a bit of a twist. It's gamified. So essentially, if say you're the entrepreneur and I'm the mentor, and you get asked a bunch of questions on this app, and for every correct answer, you get points, and you build up into a kind of league table, and the person at the top of the league table gets kind of a one-on-one session with a mentor.
I don't know. Right off the bat, again, I'm not very technologically savvy. Admittedly, I am a late adopter of technology. You know, it started off with Facebook. Even till now, I'm still quite late. But based on what you just told me, it sounds a bit gimmicky, though. I wonder how that works because, you know, you would think that, I mean, given how, you know, startups have gone about attracting, you know, mentorship and also funds, you know, there would have to be that personal relationship, that personal touching. Now that you have somewhat whittled it down to radio buttons and multiple answer, you know, survey questions, I wonder if the experience will be just, you know, will it produce, you know, better results?
Yeah, or is it just superficial, right?
Right.
I feel the same
gimmicky,
way.
Yeah.
I definitely feel the same way. That's a burning question I have, and I want to put that to Frank Meehan. I mean, gamifying this, does it trivialize entrepreneurship, you know, and mentorship of entrepreneurs? So let's I'm going to put that to him and see what he thinks, whether gamifying or turning business lessons into games is in fact the right move. The other big issue, Han, is this micro-learning platform. So this is essentially for startups, for businesses. I'm curious to know whether he sees this as edtech or education technology, which has been touted to be the next fintech. So the way fintech has disrupted the financial services industry, whether technology is set to disrupt education and transform today's classrooms.
Now, in full disclosure, I am a part-time teacher as well, you know. And noting the difference between, say, fintech and edtech, with fintech, right, these processes are pretty linear. Right, you know, it's pretty standard across the board. You know, you go through this process, bam.
Yeah,
you know,
it's like a 1-2-3 step. Right,
exactly. Yeah. Whereas with education, though, it's a lot more nuanced because you have to cater to specific students, and you know, one student might like this particular subject, whereas you know, they might fare less well at another subject. Mm. Right, so you have to cater different strategies. You know, it's. I mean, you're dealing with humans, and it's an entirely different experience, an entirely different process. So I wonder, you know, how much the disruptive nature of EdTech can actually, you know, infiltrate conventional learning as we know it. I know I do sound like a bit of a critic and a naysayer right now, and plenty of revolutionary, groundbreaking technologies and apps have had their fair share of critics, you know. But, you know, I think at this point in time, again, given my late nature when it comes to adopting
these kinds of technologies. Well, I think it's kind of a hesitance, right? So you want to see how the technology truly disrupts or benefits a certain industry. And I'm with you there.
And ultimately how it addresses, you know, the various nuances, you know, of these learning processes. It's very, very subjective.
Okay, there you go. EdTech, is it going to be the next fintech? And is this Smartup app from Frank Meehan going to be the next big thing? Let's ask him on the Breakfast Grill at 8 o'clock. And after the grill, we will continue our conversation on current affairs. Well, we started earlier in the week, if you remember, we spoke to Deborah Hardoon from Oxfam about economic inequality around the world. She recently published a report called An Economy for the 99%. That's from Oxfam. And we spoke to her about the findings. So we'll, I think, delve a little deeper into that conversation, especially given that inequality is a structural problem. And so it will need fundamental reform to tackle. It's not a conversation that's going to go away anytime soon, right, Han? And I think it's important to keep bringing it up as we go along.
Yeah, and certainly when it comes to income inequality, one of the phrases that have been oft associated with that idea is this idea of universal basic income, right? It's a form of social security, you know, in which everyone, you know, regularly receives that, you know, that set sum of pay no matter what, right? Universal basic income. But then I also note in The Guardian, you've got this recent article from a union in Finland who basically say that idea does not work, because we so often associate, you know, these Scandinavian countries like Denmark, oh, they are the beacon of happiness in the world, you know, yay, basic income is, you know, high and all that. But then you've got Finland now who says, yeah, well, not Finland as a whole, but this particular workers' union who says, yeah, that doesn't work, because ultimately there's the idea of incentive as well, right? So going back to this idea of the 1% versus 99%, you know, some might argue that there is a reason why the 1% is there, you know, granted they've got family wealth and, you know, a self-recruitment and whatnot, but, you know, you've got that. You got to have that drive, that incentive. The Bill Gates and the Mark Zuckerbergs who make their way into the 1%, right? So, you know, if you try to offset or, you know, try to balance things out in terms of income, what happens to the incentive, right?
So you're saying that people won't be incentivized to break out of whatever social strata they're in, maybe forward themselves, you know, through entrepreneurship or through other areas. That's an interesting point. I mean, there are others who say that perhaps by having, you know, your basic needs taken care of, you can then pursue your, you know, what you want to do, and in fact, maybe contribute a little bit more to society.
Oh yeah, no, certainly, yeah, I agree. You know, so the structural problems, it's easier said than done, right? You know, the idea of the American dream, you know, trying to, you know, work your way.
Do you think that's still there? I mean, the American dream. I don't know whether it's no longer a dream, as you know, just for a select few.
Yeah, the idea of just being able to work and save your way to, you know, financial wealth does not really make sense anymore, you know, given the kind of trends that we're seeing around the world, hence the discontent from the 99% against the 1%, you know. So, no, I'm totally, you know, for trying to balance it out a little bit, you know, trying to reduce the effects of these structural, you know, barriers, so to speak, right? No, I certainly get that those are huge barriers there, but at the same time, I would caution against doing too much, because then everyone gets lulled into a, you know, safety net of sorts, and there goes your initiative. You know?
Well, at 9:35 a.m. every Friday, we have the Property Show, and today on the show, real estate investments in Australia. Now, Australia has long been a target for overseas property investors, so we want to take a look at what makes investing in real estate down under so attractive, as well as explore possible pitfalls to avoid. Keith Kum will be speaking to Narita Connisby, Chief Economist at REA Group in Australia.
Now that's interesting because this show follows, you know, the headlines that we've seen and that we've covered here on the show. For example, you've got Australia, you know, ordering the sale of illegal foreign property purchases. Mm. Remember that? You know,
yeah.
We covered that a few days ago. You know, so yes, it has been attractive, but it appears that in Australia's eyes, it's been attracting the wrong kind of money as well. So you got to fit a certain criteria. You got to buy a certain property. But a certain kind of property that meets certain criteria. And yeah, I know, I don't know how open the Australian property market now is to foreign buyers.
Right? Yeah, that's right. And there are certain markets within Australia, certain cities, the property markets are really overheating. Mm. Well, let's find out more on The Property Show, what it's like to invest in real estate investments in Australia. But very quickly, Han, it's coming up to 6:12 right now. Let's take a look at the news. I was really quite fascinated yesterday on social media what was happening with US President Donald Trump and his tweet attacking clothing retailer Nordstrom after it dropped a fashion line owned by Ivanka Trump, his daughter. So Donald Trump was really heavily criticized by ethics experts for this tweet, and he tweeted, "Ivanka has been treated so unfairly by Nordstrom."
Yeah. Like, I think bringing it back down to the basic issue, right? Like, where do you draw the line between a dad looking out for his daughter versus it being an ethical problem by virtue of your position as the president of the United States, right? Like, where do you draw that line? Because, you know, in any other circumstance, if, like, a dad stands up for a daughter, I mean, Melissa, I'm just going to put you, because you're the only woman in the studio right now. So if, let's say, your dad stands up for you, right, based on something that happened at work, for example,
right,
is that an ethical dilemma then? Like, you know...
I see what you're trying to say, and for me, the line is... because Trump used his public megaphone from the White House. Mm. And that I have a problem with.
And that's a very powerful platform.
That is a very powerful platform. Mm. If he had done it in a capacity of just being a concerned dad and did it in private and using his own private platform or channels, he has to remember now that he's a public figure. I mean, certain rules don't apply anymore. And I really think there was a certain inappropriateness of him tweeting out, you know, this criticism of Nordstrom. But, you know, he's slammed companies before. We've seen it. We've talked about it. But all in all, that's essentially been in the interest of advancing the US economy. So in a small way, I can see his justification for condemning those companies. But I cannot justify why he has decided to tweet what he tweeted. In fact, Kellyanne Conway, his aide, his top aide,
yes,
also mentioned something. She appeared on TV. She urged the public to buy Ivanka Trump's brand. And she said, go and buy her products. And she has been rebuked by the White House now.
Now, if you were a consumer in the States, would you consider buying Ivanka Trump's
line? Well, that's a really fascinating movement now. Because if you note, Nordstrom is the fifth retailer to drop Ivanka Trump's clothing line. It cited a lack of sales. And this came out, Han, after the grab your wallet movement. Do you remember that? So this was... in reference to Trump's comments about, you know, women's bodies and all that. But this movement said, vote with your wallet, right? So don't buy Trump-linked products, or don't buy into Trump businesses. And it's become quite a big movement, so much so that, you know, retailers are seeing a drop in sales.
And it certainly makes sense. You know? And so going back to what you're saying, so essentially Trump's moves should be policy-driven and not personal-driven. It's not for personal reasons, right? But also, you know, in speaking about his tweet activities, you've got this story on CNBC whereby this analyst says that, you know, the Trump association with Twitter is not exactly good because at the end of the day, advertisers will vote with their wallet as well. Like,
right.
Do they want to be associated with a media platform that is now very often synonymous with Donald Trump, brand Trump, right?
That's right. Shares in Twitter have fallen more than 10%. And this is after the company reported fourth quarter losses had nearly doubled. So it reported losses of $167 million in the final three months of 2016. If you compare that, Twitter reported $90 million in the same period a year ago. So I guess Donald Trump's Twitter curse is not really not doing anything to boost or to add, you know, users or income, right?
Yeah, well, we'll see whether it is a curse, you know, as such. But yeah, you know, when you consider Twitter's share price from its high of $73 in December of 2013 to where it is now, about $16 plus per share, yeah, it's a massive drop. So down 12.4% overnight. Yeah.
Okay, well, it's 6:15 now, and, you know, some light-hearted news, well, some sad news from the entertainment industry. Aretha Franklin has announced her retirement yesterday. The Queen of Soul turns 75 this year, but she says she will record an album with Stevie Wonder before she quits. So because of that news, here we're going to play for you Aretha Franklin with Baby, I Love You on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Norwegian Wood by The Beatles there. Hello and good morning. 6:21 right now. I'm Melissa Idris with Tan Chung Han here. And we're thinking about napping this morning. Napping for productivity. Because in most countries, sleeping on the job isn't just frowned upon. It may get you fired. So no napping on the desk, Han.
Oh, dang it.
Unless you're in Japan.
Oh.
Where napping in the office is common and culturally accepted. In fact, it's seen as a subtle sign of diligence because you must be working yourself to exhaustion if you need to take a nap on your desk.
Now, I wonder if there's an equivalent here in the Malaysian context. Not napping per se, but, you know, this subtle sign of diligence. You know, when people ask, oh, how are you? And you just always answer, tired lah. You know, I wonder
if
there's like a subtle thing like, wow, this guy works so hard now. Wow, every time tired one. Huh?
I know what it is. Another one is also where you come to work even though you're deadly sick. You're sick as a dog and you're sniffy and your head, you know, you're tired. You clearly have a fever, but you come to work because, you know, you're diligent.
Now, I just want to give a word of caution to the producers and the interns of BFM's morning run team. Now, that is not supposed to give you any ideas, so please come to work.
But it's our warped view of what a diligent worker is. And I wonder whether it's a cultural thing. So in Japan, there's a word for it. It's called inemuri. It means sleeping on duty or in a way kind of sleeping while present. So you are so tired because you've been working so hard that, you know, you kind of close your eyes for a second, even though you're in the office. And I wonder whether that is... Is that a good thing? I mean, we're not, no judgment here, but is it something that we can relate to here in Malaysia?
Well, I think it stems from their culture over there where relatively, there is no separation between work and life balance, right? You know, where else in modern industrial and developed countries, by extension, you know, countries who aspire to be like them, you know, i.e. the urban class here in Malaysia, you know, we like to gravitate towards that idea. So we should have that shorter working hours so that we have the work-life balance.
Right.
Where else in Japan, you know, that's not something that's, you know, obviously being celebrated or, you know, chased after. So, you know, I guess in that context, then the napping at your desk thing works. Where else, if you do subscribe to the work-life balancing, you do want to be productive during those work hours. So how can you be napping on the job and be productive?
Exactly.
You want to get the job done and then go nap at home and have that life balance, right?
You know, one of my friends who works in Australia, now she is unable to... So if you... you know, I think the work hours are till 9 to 5:30 or something. If you stay back longer than 5:30, your boss will ask you, are you inefficient during the day, that you cannot get your work done and when everyone else has also gotten their work done at 5:30. So but here we go, don't leave until after the boss leaves, because that shows, you know, you're diligent and you're a hard worker. But that's really not the case. It's about time management and productivity. Although I have to say, Han, I would love to have a little sign on my desk that says, inemuri, so maybe after lunch I can take a quick power nap at my desk, sleeping on the job.
Now, I do have an Australian story to tag onto your friend's Australian experience. So I used to work in KPMG Sydney, not in the audit side, but just in the media side. But what I loved about that gig, they had a nap pod.
So
you,
what?
Yeah, okay, true story. It is awesome. So you've got this like half egg kind of thing which extends into a sofa of sorts, and you have a proper booking system online. So every day, because I was my shift starts at about 7-8 o'clock, you know, because I had set up all these conferences and, you know, international calls and whatnot, so I would get in the earliest, and then I get to book the nap pod every day.
How long do you get to book it for?
For increments of half an hour. So you have a nap pod that's in this wellness room, and you can go in there.
A wellness room.
And you can pull like this cover over, and like you, if you wanted to, there's ambience music. You know, there's and it's this acoustically treated cocoon of sorts where you don't really hear outside noise. It is great.
Okay, so I have to ask, do power naps work? Hmm. I mean, research has shown that a 20 to 30 minute power nap, in fact, boosts productivity later for you. But I wonder, when for you personally, do power naps work for you?
Okay, historically speaking, no. In the past, when I do take a nap, it starts off as a nap, and then it extends into what I call a neep. You know, it's like a 3-hour nap, basically a nap or a sleep. You know, so a neep, yeah, that's what I call it. Now, copyright Hantan. All right, so that's what I've been used to. But of late, actually, I got BFM to blame for this. I've started doing this whole power nap thing where I feel truly energized after like 10 minutes. I don't know what it is. So, and I was trying to figure this out because I've been here about a month now. And it's basically, I think it's the adrenaline from knowing that I still have stuff to do after this nap. So that jolts me awake and it's like, all right, you know, power nap's done. Let's go back to work. So I think that's the formula that I've got right now. I don't know. What about you?
No, I can't take power naps. In fact, I've discovered that, you know, I know sleep is very important. So I used to do an incremental sleep thing where I'll take a 2-hour nap in the afternoon and then a 3 hours of sleep at night. But now I've realized power naps don't work for me. So what I'll do is I'll just make sure I get enough sleep at night. So I sleep early. I just move my bedtime earlier.
But that seems to be a luxury of late, right? Because, you know, how many times, you know, can we, working class and middle class people, you know, those of us who have to work those long hour jobs, right? How many of us can say that we can get 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep, you know? Also coupled by the fact that our culture tends to sleep later at night, right? You know, we go to bed at like midnight, whereas our Aussie counterparts might be in bed by 10, right? So, you know, it's almost a luxury that you can have 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep.
But you know, Han, it's not just working adults, it's children as well, especially teenagers, because, you know, they're kind of distracted by social media, and you're right, the culture of staying up late. So there are some high schools, this is specific to the US though, there are some high schools trying a new cure for teenagers who stay up late and who doze off in class. Teachers are letting them nap in school. So how power naps have worked for you, do you think power naps will work for teenagers in school?
So again, I teach teenagers currently and I would say no. Because when you do give them that free time or that downtime, the last thing they want to do is nap. They want to like hang out with their friends and play, you know, like, or get on their phones. You know, they are constantly active. I guess, you know, they're making full use. They're being productive in a way, you know, when it comes to their time with friends, you know, because once they go home, you know, it's pretty much an isolated experience there. So it's good in theory, but I wonder how much the kids will actually enjoy napping, especially with their friends around.
Well, schools are now trying nap clubs. So similar to what you have, like that nap pod in KPMG. So nap clubs are essentially quiet rooms where no speaking or no technology is allowed in there. It's like a little wellness center for schools in the US, trying to deal with the fact that some teenagers just simply don't get enough sleep, and that affects their concentration in school.
I don't know, but based on your experience, I mean, come on, Melissa, it wasn't that long ago. Do you think it would have worked for you?
Not at all. Yeah. Not in a heartbeat.
Chit-chat.
I would use it to skip class, and I'm just saying that as a really naughty student.
Yeah,
but there are also businesses tapping into this where they have meditation and nap studios around cities. So you can, again, go in and pay, say, US $15 for a half an hour nap room. So you go in, you take a bit of a nap, have a little bit of shut eye. And I wonder whether that's That's the right way. I mean, will we see this like Airbnb for nappers in the future?
I think that's actually a great thing, especially I actually kind of had this pseudo business idea for a while, whereby if we do have these kind of services in malls for the very tired and weary husbands
and boyfriends.
Dads.
Oh, I can imagine.
They have to accompany their significant others to the mall and they are tired. Hey, NetPod right here. Again, copyright hunt time 2017, so thank you very much.
That's a good business idea. Have some angel investors get in touch with you.
Right. Maybe I should sign up with Meehan.
With Frank Meehan on the Breakfast Grill, since he is quite the global technopreneur and investor. Okay, we've got the 6:30 news bulletin coming up next with Lynn Mark on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, She's Waiting by Eric Clapton. Hello and good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Tan Chung Han here with me. And we're going to continue our discussion on anti-stress, you know, napping at work, napping at school, perhaps nipping out for a nap, for a 15-minute nap when you're out and about in town. Now, Pope Francis has said that his secret for dealing with stress is to write down all his problems into a letter to St. Joseph. And he then places the missives under a statue of the man he described in the Bible as the carpenter father of Jesus. So he is essentially writing down his worries in a way to relieve stress.
Now, that is certainly a very common approach when it comes to dealing with stress, you know, because it is cathartic, right? You write down your problems and you see it on paper, and then some online articles have suggested and then you then burn it, you know, or like throw it away, and it's one of those. Again, it's very relieving. It's very cathartic, right? It lets you get all those emotions and stress points out. But at the same time, you know, there's certainly a bit of mental gymnastics involved, because at least for me, it doesn't really work, because yeah, I'm writing it down, I go through the motions, but that doesn't really make the problem go away.
Does it work if it's on the computer? I mean, if you type it out and then you delete the file, is that the same kind of catharsis?
But you don't get the same sense of crumpling that paper up
and then throw into the dustbin.
Yeah, you like can't set your laptop on fire. You know, like you can set that paper on fire. I mean, you could if you wanted to, but that would just cost you some money.
Okay, so that's a practical anti-stress secret from the Pope. But he also says that he always sleeps 6 hours a day, and that is coming back to what we were discussing about making sure you get enough sleep. And you know, if you don't, then you might need power naps throughout the day. I don't know whether sleeping on the job is something that's susceptible for a Pope.
Right. Those mass ceremonies can get quite long. So you could take a power nap in, I don't know. But 6 hours, though, I mean, is that enough for you? I don't think it is for me.
Well, they say that 8 hours for children and 6 hours for an adult. So I guess 6 hours a day is the bare minimum that someone must get in terms of, you know, a good night's rest.
I've gone up to 12 hours sometimes. I'm not going to lie. So
well, he also prays. I mean, that's a given. He is the Pope. But I think that's also, you know, the spiritual element to that is also a great stress reliever. But the other and most interesting anti-stress secret that the Pope has revealed is that to live in peace, you need a healthy, couldn't care less attitude. What do you think about this? I mean, he says that this is something that the Italians have taught him, and he reckons that this is really good. It's a good way to handle stress.
Yeah, I mean, I would think I guess it depends on your responsibilities in that society, right? Because there are many things beyond your control. And if you just take it to mean that, you know, you just focus on what you can do, what you can achieve, what you can influence, then perhaps there is some merit to that approach. I think the key caveat here, or the key adjective here, is the healthy couldn't care less attitude. Not just any couldn't care less attitude, but a healthy one. So obviously that is open to suggestion, but I'm sure there are some pitfalls, you know, for this.
Yeah,
attitude.
You know, I have to say, when I read that, I was a little bit shocked, because I was like, I don't know if this is the right prescription you should be telling people in a way to relieve stress. I completely understand it, because if you care about everything, it will just drive you bonkers with stress, right? And no human being can care about everything. And that's why more often than not, we only care about things that happen in our backyard that have a direct correlation to us and our loved ones. It's, again, you know, you look at the headlines and it's really hard to make people care. When I say people, I mean, I'm generalizing here, but the masses care about the latest bomb attack in Afghanistan or the drone strike in Yemen or the raid with Donald Trump. And, you know, the scores and scores of people who have been displaced and, you know, affected by the Syrian refugee crisis. So, again, I think it's really hard to make people care about everything. But you have to care about more than just your bubble, I think. It's important to care at least about some things that you feel strongly about.
Well, that is certainly a theme that, you know, we and just basically everyone out there has been debating, right? The battle, the seeming battle between globalization versus localization, right? Be it investment tips to even just what you care about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when you strive to be a globalized citizen, yeah, it might seem noble. But like you said, Melissa, you know, there is an endless stream of, you know, turmoils and issues that you can possibly care about. And what is another disturbing element to this, if let's say person A cares about issue A and you are person B who cares about issue B, and then often on social media, person or group A might make you feel guilty for not caring about person A, you know, or issue A.
Oh, okay.
You know,
so
what
that's
I mean?
A guilt factor.
Yeah, you know,
okay.
So, but again, now, where do you draw that line? Because there's just an endless plethora of issues and global themes that you can worry about, right? Because, you know, if you maybe twist it a little bit and say perhaps care for local issues or issues that are directly related to you and care for them deeply, now, then perhaps that's another twist to it, you know, because, again, trying to care about everything in the world, I don't know.
Yeah, I do think it's important to care, at least in terms of our civic mindedness. You know, I mean, if you care about local issues, fantastic, but make sure you care and you're vocal about it. I think for me, apathy is the worst, the worst disease among the community. And that's why when I read the Pope saying that perhaps a couldn't care less attitude is a good stress reliever or a way to manage stress, I was a little worried. But again, the caveat is a healthy couldn't care less attitude. So something that doesn't drive you up the wall with worry at night and you can't sleep because you're worried about drone attacks in the Middle East.
Right. And just to perhaps illustrate what I was talking about, say you have a full-time volunteer at your local SPCA, right? And this person dedicates their entire, you know, every single waking moment, you know, tending to the poor animals at the SPCA. You've got that end of the spectrum, but then at the same time, you know, perhaps, say, someone who is a great influencer on social media and who draws attention to many, many, many different themes, right? So you could almost argue that there is a time and place for both,
right?
But I think the common theme here is that at least care for something, you know, do enlarge your mind, do broaden your experiences and, you know, show empathy and awareness of many things that are going on. But when it comes to action, though, I think it has to be placed somewhere, be it just full-time at your local SPCA or in a very broad theme.
That is a very good point because you can make the distinction between caring and action, right? So I have to say that we can't take action for everything that we care about, all the causes that we want to champion the world.
Yeah.
There's just simply not enough time, you know, in hours in the day, and you might end up taking power naps at your desk in the office. But I do wonder whether that caring element of it, Han, I mean, there's a way to care but not drive yourself crazy. And the way is to keep an open mind. So let's say I don't know much about animal rights or it's not part of my immediate circle of causes that I'm championing, right? But having a hearing or listening to someone talk about it, for instance, and by keeping an open mind, you can care in that moment and educate yourself. And I think that's a way to care as well, just by educating yourself.
But then also just continuing with that theme, and you know, you do see the rise of these keyboard warriors who operate under the pretense of caring, but you know, how much can you care in 140 characters or, you know, in a Facebook status, right? Here's looking at you, Donald Trump, you know. I mean, somewhat, you know. But yeah, again, there has to be some element of active participation, active effort. I do see the value in, you know, raising awareness via your social media platforms on certain issues, but you know, at some point in time there has to be, you know, more substantive elements to that.
You know, I was talking to some friends over dinner the past few months, I remember a few months ago, and I remember saying, talking about the need for better oversight for financial governance in the country. And it was a really
wow, that's
weird,
a dinner topic
it was
for you.
A really weird conversation, but you know, it was related to things that were happening in the news and, you know, financial scandals that have been rocking the country for many years now. So we were talking about that at dinner, and one of my friends said, you know what, I'm struggling to make ends meet at the end of the day. I've got financial problems of myself. I can't be thinking about the financial problems of the country. And that really struck me because it goes to show that, and I remember, I think Rafizi Ramli mentioned this. He said financial scandals are enough to change someone's a voter's thinking or consideration at the ballot box. And I'm inclined to disagree with him because I don't think it's enough. I think people are worried about their own bread and butter issues. You know, when you think about what causes people the most stress, it's often financial issues. I mean, trying to get your you know, what little savings you have at the end of the month, it's making ends meet. And I think that's the biggest worry most people have. How can you make people care about more than that? Because that's the most pressing issue for most people, just trying to make ends meet.
I would certainly agree with that. And I would make that distinction whereby you've got people who have to worry about their bread and butter issues. And you see those themes playing out in our local by-elections, right? They don't care about 1MDB. You know, they just want to worry about the effects of the rising cost of living, GST, right, for example. But so some have actually argued that what issues like 1MDB is an issue for the privileged. We've got our bread and butter issues sorted out. Now we can expand our radar, so to speak, and worry, and I'm using air quotes here, worry about 1MDB. Because ultimately, though, then you have to ask the question, how does the 1MDB saga really affect you personally, right? So is it a battle of ideals?
Mm.
You know, and it's not really a bread and butter issue. You know, and in fact, several people have, you know, come out to, you know, kind of encourage the discussion along those lines.
You know what? We want to hear from you. Tell us what you think. Is there such a thing as a healthy tidak apa attitude, a healthy couldn't care less attitude? And is that a good thing? Tell us on Twitter at BFM Radio or tweet or you can WhatsApp us at 016-201-9000. I mean, this is an interesting topic and I'm sure many of you have strong feelings about this. We would love to hear from you. It's now 6:50 and the Jimi Hendrix Experience is coming up next with Fire on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.